LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Gary Lachman, who joins us to discuss his latest book, Revolutionaries of the Soul, Reflections on Magicians, Philosophers, and Occultists. Explorers of occult mysteries and the edges of consciousness change the way we view not only the nature of reality, but also our deepest sense of self. In Revolutionaries of the Soul, Lachman presents punchy, enlightening, and intriguing biographies of some of the most influential esoteric luminaries in recent history. His subjects include Swedish mystical scientist Emanuel Swedenborg, Helena Blavatsky, Russian co-founder of the Theosophical Society, Austrian philosopher Rudolf Steiner, who inspired the Waldorf School of Education, Swiss visionary Carl Jung, founder of depth psychology, notorious English ceremonial magician Aleister Crowley, Russian esotericist P.D. Uspensky, an explicator of Gurdjieff's early works, and British psychic artist Dion Fortune, who was influential in the modern revival of magical arts. Hello and welcome, Gary, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Now, Gary, today we're going to talk about your new book, which is entitled Revolutionaries of the Soul, Reflections on Magicians, Philosophers, and Occultists. Before we dive into that, just give listeners a little bit of information about your background and your work in general.
Well, I'm a writer. I write about, the Western esoteric tradition, but also in sort of a context of Western philosophy and history and literature. I was a musician many years ago, and it was back in the late 1970s, and it was around then that I first became interested in the sort of thing I write about. I read a couple books, one by a British writer named Colin Wilson, who died recently, just at the end of 2013, a book called The Occult that came out in the early 70s, and it was sort of general overview, history of, and sort of philosophical analysis of the occult and the paranormal and the esoteric tradition and that sort of thing. And around the same time, I read a book by Aleister Crowley, Moonchild, one of his novels. And I became quite fascinated with the whole notion of the occult and the esoteric tradition. And ever since then, I've been reading it, different people writing about it, different thinkers and philosophers and so on. And this current book is a collection of magazine articles, little sort of potted biographies of some of the leading figures in the esoteric tradition, and of some people that aren't as well known. And this book comes at the end of almost two decades of writing about this stuff. I first started writing magazine articles and book reviews in the early 90s in about this kind of material. And some of the articles go back to, I think, about 1995. So, and up until probably as recently as probably the late 2000s, which is a funny thing to say already these days. But they cover quite a lot of ground. So that's sort of the general area of my interest.
Well, I think you must have found your style quite early on, because there's no indication really when you're reading the book that any of these articles are any older or more recent than any of the others.
Well, I neaten them up a bit, but to tell you the truth, not a great deal. So I myself can detect a little bit of difference from the earliest sort of pieces. The later ones seem to be a little less hesitant. I mean, I practiced for a long time. I always wanted to write. That was something I wanted to do since I was in my teens. And the urge to do that first came out in poetry, none of which has survived, as I say in the beginning of the book, and I'm very thankful for that. Subsequently, you know, all throughout the time, and I was a musician, and then after that, I went back to university, and I got a degree in philosophy, and I thought that's what I was going to do. I thought I was going to become basically a philosophy professor. Fate had other things planned for me. But during the whole time when I was in university, I was writing as well. But it took quite a while for me to sort of, you know, to write anything that that would be worth reading, or as I say in the beginning of the book, that a publisher would actually publish. I guess it took work. So there was a long stretch when nothing I wrote was actually that good. And to tell you the truth, I mean, the best thing that ever happened to me was sending an article to there was a magazine called Gnosis that was around in the late 80s and 90s. And it was very, it was called the Journal of the Western Esoteric Tradition. And I sent them an article I'd written about Rudolf Steiner. And they were very nice about it, and they sent it back, and they said it was a bit too long, and, you know, it's a little repetitive, and so on and so on. And then I, instead of sort of cringing in despair at having my work rejected, I basically, you know, looked at what they said, thought, okay, I made the changes, and sent it back, and they accepted it. So I learned that this is possible, this can be done, and, you know, you can learn how to do it.
Yeah.
That's my advice to any aspiring writers out there. It's possible. To do it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing since the late 80s, and I sometimes get people, younger people, asking me, oh, I'd love to be a writer, you know, what do I do? And I say, write. You know, there's nothing.
Yeah, that's the best way, right? Yeah, yeah.
There's no substitute for it, isn't there, really? Just do it.
No, you just have, it's sort of like digging a channel in a way. I mean, you write through a lot of stuff that, you know, you cringe later on when you read it, and, you know, a lot of rubbish, but it's developing this sort of channel. I mean, in the sense of digging through something, you're sort of digging through some material, and you're opening up a way for what you have to say to come out of you. And the thing that's usually the case is, rather than feeling you have nothing to say, you actually have too much to say. That's the thing that I always found difficult. And that's still the case now. Whenever I start a book, by the time I'm about to start it, I feel like I've got so much jammed up in me that I need to get out, that the first few, you know, beginnings, the first few sort of attempts to get going, you're usually throwing everything just down on the page, and then it takes a while for it to settle into this nice kind of flow, which is what the reader wants. And I think if I get into that and I'm enjoying the actual writing, then I think with any luck the reader will enjoy reading it, because the same experience happens, this kind of flow, this kind of nice, easy, gentle kind of current of ideas. And again, my model for this is this writer, Colin Wilson, whose book The Occult had a big influence on me. And he's my next project. The next book I'm about to start is a study of his ideas. I mean, he's written an enormous number of books. He started writing in the late 1950s. His first book was a book called The Outsider, and it was about existentialism, basically. And then he subsequently, by the early 70s, he had turned his attentions to the occult, because there had been this big occult boom in the 1960s and into the early 70s in publishing. There was a lot of interest in the occult. And it was something that he had been interested in on the side, but it wasn't sort of a solid kind of central interest. But a publisher asked him if he'd be interested in writing a book about it. And he accepted the commission initially because he needed the money. But then as he did the research, he discovered there was, there was basically enough evidence for the reality of the occult for, you know, to convince any open-minded person. And what impressed me the most, and what got me interested in his work, was that he approached it from a philosophical point of view. It wasn't sort of a kind of collection of sensational stories, but he's looking at it in terms of his philosophy of consciousness and things of that sort. And so over the years from reading his books, he's such a good, easy stylist, without being, simplifying. You know, he's not dumbing down to his readers, but he has a very fluid, clear style that gets you interested in what he's writing about. And if I can match that in any way, I'm very happy.
Well, I would say that, in my experience over the years, for a certain type of person, that The Outsider, as you mentioned, which is Colin Wilson's debut, and The Occult are two of the most commonly spotted books on shelves, which actually haven't been read. For some reason, there's a certain class of person who sort of feels the need to own them, but maybe never quite gets around to reading them. I don't know what that is.
Well, I, in one sense, feel sorry for them if they haven't read them, but I also envy them if they do get around to reading them, because they'll, for me, they're just very, very important books. You know, I guess that, you know, he has a name and a reputation, and I can see where people feel they should have it on his shelves. I think for some people, it may seem a bit too intellectual, because, again, he's writing about the occult, but he puts it into the context of Western literature and philosophy, and he's always referencing people like Sartre or Heidegger or Goethe or Blake or people like that. So it isn't your sort of straightforward kind of book, you know, about the occult. And again, he really sees it in the context of his ideas about consciousness. And if, as I have done, and obviously other people have done as well, you go back to his earlier books and you start with The Outsider and you read up to the occult, you see where he's developing these ideas. I mean, I think a lot of people do read The Outsider and they think that's what he's about. Because this was the big book, the book that, you know, made him famous and basically made his career and so on. And it's a brilliant book for a 23-year-old, you know, to have written. But it really is just the beginning of this whole body of work that you know, he built over a lifetime. I mean, he was still writing. He suffered a stroke some years ago and prevented him, you know, from writing. But up until then, he was still going. You know, during his lifetime, he went through different periods. He had this enormous success when he was young, and then he fell out of favor with the critics for a very long time, and then he was successful again with The Occult, and then with a few books following after that, and then he kind of sort of went into eclipse again. But recently, people like Philip Pullman have sort of come out in his favor and pointing out it's just this kind of snobbishness that the British literary establishment has against him, that they haven't really accepted him after all these years. Perhaps now that he's dead, he might get a fresh look. That's one thing I'm hoping to do with the book I'm doing. I'm also writing an introduction to a new edition of The Outsider that's coming out in the U.S. around the same time as my book about him will be coming out. So I mean, let's hope people who don't know about him can learn about him through these efforts.
Well, if I've read criticism of Colin Wilson, it's been along the lines of the fact that he ranged too widely in some people's in some people's opinion. It's like, who is he, you know, to write on this subject? But that's the thing that I liked the most, was he could turn his hand to anything.
Well, exactly. I mean, me too. I mean, and I think also, though, again, he started, well, again, he, you know, when he first came out, he was this brilliant, you know, working class, unschooled, certainly he didn't go to university, you know, homegrown existentialist, and then the sort of, you know, snooty literary critics had turned against him, you know, the ones who were praising him turned against him. And I think what also happened is over the years, we've increasingly become over-specialized, and certainly lots of areas now that just a general, you know, reader or a general well-read kind of critic or, you know, man of letters could write about. Now you sort of have to have, you know, an academic specialization to sort of say anything about it and be accepted, which is ridiculous. When you look back at people like Aldous Huxley, I mean, you know, Wilson wasn't doing anything different than Aldous Huxley had done. Huxley had written about lots of different sorts of things. He wasn't doing anything different than Arthur Koestler. who was another writer who's gone into eclipse, who died in about 1980. But he's most famous for his novel Darkness at Noon, which was about the Stalinist show trials. But in the 60s and 70s, he wrote books against reductionism in science, against behaviorism in psychology. He was one of the mainstream intellectuals to take parapsychology seriously, and he wrote a book called The Roots of Coincidence, and so on. He came out as an anti-Darwinist and things of that sort, but he wrote on a wide range of subjects, and he wasn't an academic. But we've reached this kind of very it's a bad time, I think. You know, the whole idea of the man of letters is kind of completely gone into eclipse. You have to be a specialist now, and I think in many ways that's also affected the actual, you know, quality of the writing, if I have to do say so myself, where it becomes, I don't know how to say it. What I like about Wilson and Huxley and Kessler and writers like that is they have this easy grasp of their material. They know what they're talking about, but they don't, you know, they don't bludgeon you to death. And they assume you're an intelligent reader who just wants to know about this sort of thing. That's why you're reading the book. And I always feel like I'm sitting and having a conversation, or at least in company with them. Whereas, you know, many writers these days, I don't get that feeling. You know, they know their stuff. They know their material. It's put together, you know, nice and neatly, and it's a kind of standard kind of style. I'm thinking of, you know, the kind of milieu I write in. I don't know what you want to call it, alternative or, you know, whatever, mind, body, spirit or whatever it is kind of thing. And again, you didn't have that kind of those kind of genres, you know, set in stone, you know, fixed in kind of little market niches when Colin Wilson was writing and these other people were as well. So I think the idea of the sort of generally educated reader and the generally educated writer have kind of, you know, they faded in many ways. I have that problem myself when I'm with my own books, where increasingly you get the copy editor, you know, someone who's going through your manuscript, pointing out all these kind of things, and, you know, sort of the idea is that the reader isn't going to know. You know, if you just say Einstein, the reader's not going to know it's Albert Einstein. You say Shakespeare, the reader's not going to know it's William. I mean, who is it? Ernie Shakespeare?
Yeah.
Is it Fred Shakespeare? Are they really going to be confused? But this idea that the reader today is just, you know, you can't assume that they know anything. So in any case, I think I agree with you. He wrote too much, but then he's brilliant. You know, I mean, I think his mistakes are probably more enlightening than many people's bullseyes, you know, I would say. And this was, again, something that was also true of one of the people he writes about and was influenced by as well, was H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells wrote, you know, a huge amount of stuff of varying kind of, you know, quality. But there was always this remarkable kind of vigor and interest and this sort of drive in him that I think, you know, whether you agree with the actual content, the explicit message of his books, at least for me, I get caught up in just this drive he has, you know. And that's a similar thing that I find with Colin Wilson's books. You know, he wrote a lot. He wrote a great deal, close to 200 titles. You know, not everything is of the same quality, but everything is informed with this kind of insatiable sort of curiosity.
Yeah, I think that's the key, really, isn't it? It's for me, and you obviously picked up on that, it's just that this wanting to know and wanting to communicate, being enthusiastic about ideas. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that to me is what, you know, basically, you know, what's the word, made me a devotee, because I found that I learned a great deal from reading him. He talks about all these other writers and books and philosophers and so on, and then, you know, you follow them up, and that's what I did. You can get a what used to be a liberal arts, you know, education from following all the kind of leads that he you know, lays down in his books, like the big books like The Occult or Mysteries, which was the follow up. And then he has this remarkable book called The Criminal History of Mankind, came out in the 80s, that is something like Wells's, you know, outline of history, but, you know, from the point of view of mankind's criminal urges and so on.
Well, Colin Wilson was definitely a major influence in nonfiction, certainly in making, you know, giving me the impulse to write. And I had, there wasn't a second-hand bookshop in our town when I was growing up. There was just like a new one. But in the neighboring town, there was a second-hand bookshop, and it was in a covered market. And it was a classic everything you want from a secondhand bookshop. There was a scruffy guy in there who was smoking roll-ups and he had long hair and books were piled everywhere. When he got new books in, he didn't always arrange them straight away. He just heaped them up on the floor. There were just books everywhere and dust. And once he picked up on the fact that I was interested in the occult and the paranormal and what have you, he started putting books aside for me. It was very good of him because he could have had handsome prices for these, but he never put them on the shelves. He put them to one side for when I would come along. And one of these books was The Occult, you know, that was a real, it was a real life-changing moment.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful bookshop, which sadly I think is more and more going by the wayside. I don't find them anymore. But no, I had similar experience when I, after I became sort of a dedicated Wilsonian, I looked for his books everywhere. And this happened when I was a musician, so I was in the East Coast and then in the West Coast in the States, and I traveled around. And so every town I went to, as you just said, I tried to find, you know, the secondhand bookshops. Not all of them had them, but some of them had quite a few, places like San Francisco and places like that. And I would just track down all these copies of his books where in some places they knew they were collectible and so they were pricey, and other ones they weren't. What can I say? I mean, a great deal of the people that I know about, the writers that have influenced me, come from, you know, that first reading I had of Wilson's The Occult. And the follow-up to that, The Mysteries, I think, is in some ways even more had more an effect on me. I remember when in 1983, I went on this sort of mini search for the miraculous with a friend of mine, and one of the places I wound up going to Fontainebleau to find the Prairie, where Gurdjieff had his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man. But another spot for me was to go down to Cornwall, to a little place called Goran Haven, which is where Colin Wilson lived, and I made this pilgrimage there. But I was carrying around a copy of Mysteries, which came out in 1978, which is a follow-up to The Occult. And there's a lot in there about earth mysteries and earth magic, and that was something I was very into at the time. And I was hunting down, ley lines and trying to douse and, you know, going to different standing stones. And he had written quite a bit about that in there. I had this, to me, you know, fantastic time of, you know, going and visiting him and staying there. And we stayed up late and we drank wine and all this kind of thing. I had a terrific hangover the next day. But he was very, you know, he was very friendly, very, very, you know, generous and open and warm. And that became a friendship that lasted until just recently when he died. I subsequently visited him several times in Cornwall. Later on, when I was living in Los Angeles, when he came to give some talks there, he stayed with me at a house I was house-sitting for up in the Hollywood Hills, this wonderful place that I called the Zen Castle. It was three floors, and it had a garden and a rock garden and a jacuzzi and everything and all that. So I was happy to put him up. And we stayed, you know, it was the beginning of a real kind of, both friendship and, I don't know what you want to say. I mean, I don't want to make too strong a connection, but I certainly focused on his work, you know, for until now. I mean, and even during that time when I went back to university in the 80s and I got a degree in philosophy, I still continued to read his work. I mean, that was an interesting situation for myself, just tangentially to say, because I was getting a degree in Western philosophy. I was more or less focusing on existentialism and things of that sort. But by about the mid-80s, I was working in this New Age bookshop that became sort of world famous through the actress Shirley MacLaine. She had this television miniseries called Out on a Limb about her experiences in the New Age and in the spiritual world and all that. And she mentioned the shop in this, and overnight it became, you know, very, very popular. So I was there at the height, sort of the beginning of the whole kind of real wide popularity of the sort of New Age sort of thing. I worked the night shift, so I was sort of Western philosopher by day and you know, mystic by night. And it was an interesting sort of situation to be in, because I could see the advantages and disadvantages of both sort of sides from that perspective.
Just a closing thought on Colin Wilson, really, is for me, I just found him a very inspiring figure because, and one person actually who I really did want to interview, and I picked up his little book, Superconsciousness. And as little as it is, I thought this is really a summation of his whole outlook on life, and that would be a perfect opportunity to speak with him. And then I emailed him, and a couple of days later, I read the news that he passed on.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't meant to be. But
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it was such an inspiring little book, and just this idea that in a sense we create our own reality if we imbue our lives with purpose and are optimistic. Then that's what comes out the other end, so to speak, you know. And the Faculty X, which you speak about, and for me, the super consciousness, it's one core idea that runs throughout his work.
No, you're absolutely right. And funny you should mention it, because I'm currently teaching an online course using the book Super Consciousness. It's a course for a place called the California Institute of Integral Studies that's in San Francisco. That's been around for a long time, and it has some important people on its faculty, people like Stanislav Grof, Richard Tarnas, who wrote this wonderful book called Passion of the Western Mind that came out in the early 90s, there's quite a few other people there. And I'm doing a course. It's called Phenomenology as a Mystical Discipline, and we're using superconsciousness. One reason is because what you say, it is a kind of nice, handy, you know, compact sort of précis of his work and his ideas. And the other reason is the books I wanted to use, which were some of the earlier philosophical books of his, part of what he called his outsider cycle, they're just not available. They're just not in print. Or they're available at, you know, ridiculous prices. So this was the best I could do. And some students are getting it a lot, quite a bit. Some they don't quite get him, but I think a lot of them, again, he comes from this Western philosophical literary kind of background, and some of the references he makes, I don't think they quite, you know, they're not usually the names that you hear in the context of, you know, the kind of milieu in which this course is being given. So people like Sartre or Beckett or people like that. But some of them do get it. And I agree with you. I mean, I've read it a few times already, the book, and rereading it for the course, there are places where I say, yeah, that's it's there. It's kind of, you know, and again, if you know a writer's work and you've read it many times over years, you begin to develop, a real kind of sympathy with it. And so I can see where he's putting a lot behind, you know, these sort of simple stories that he's telling about his own experiences with, you know, achieving these more intense states of consciousness. Or what he's very good at is getting these very, very good metaphors, or these good similes, or these good sort of images that can encapsulate these basic ideas. And one of the ones that he talks about in that book, and he borrows it from the novelist L.H. Myers, is what he calls the near and the far. You know, this is kind of the dilemma of man, which, you know, he mentions in the beginning of this novel, The Near and the Far, by Myers, where it takes place in medieval India, and there's a young prince named Prince Jali, and he's on a castle, and he's looking out in the desert, and he reflects, there's two deserts, you know, he's seeing the sunset go down, and he's saying there's a desert that is a beauty to the eye, with all the wonderful colors of the sunset and all that, but the other desert is a weariness to the feet, and that if he raced, you know, across the sands to try and capture the glory of the sunset, the promise of the horizon, all he would do is get sand in his shoes, and this is the kind of dilemma. And I just think that's just a wonderful kind of, you know, encapsulation of the whole sort of romantic kind of problem. You know, how can we capture the promise of the horizon? You know, is it really only an illusion? Is everything near? You know, because when you race to the horizon, you get there. That's near. I mean, I told my class, and I mentioned this to friends, how I'm walking in London here. I often see the sunset going down over St. John's Wood or Kilburn, and it looks magical. But I know if I go there, I know what's there. You know, and the same thing that's over here where I am in West Hampstead. But somehow that distance and the colors and, you know, all this sort of thing. And this is the kind of, you know, romantic dilemma. And that Wilson's, you know, for him, you know, the romantics tried to do this and they were defeated by it. The existentialists, they basically said, well, no, forget about the far. There's only the near. And we have to make, you know, do the best we can just with the near. And Collins saying, no, you know, we can capture the, we can capture the horizon. We can capture the promise. And here, read my book. This is how we can do it. So, there you go.
Okay, well, as mentioned, we've been talking about Colin Wilson, but of course, your new book, just to remind listeners, Revolutionaries of the Soul, there's all sorts of characters here, 16 in total that you cover, including Carl Jung, Rudolf Steiner, Aleister Crowley, we mentioned at the top of the hour. We're going to be getting to all of these eventually. But one thing, just a general point, one thing that struck me, and this is, you know, relevant to what we were talking about with Colin Wilson, is just how so many of these people, if not all of them, were virtually what we would call today polymaths. There were so many things that they did, that they tried to do, that they could do, so many areas that they got into. And it seems that this is something, as you alluded to, that seems to be almost out of fashion now. It's seen as a bit like, you know, in the early days of the scientific revolution, for example, most of the scientists were gentlemen privately funded, and they just went physics, chemistry, biology, you name it, they went where they went. And that's something that really comes across in this cast of characters in your book.
No, I think you're right. Again, it's this age of specialization we have now, and sort of professionalism, in the sense that, you know, that everyone has their patch, and that's, you know, that's what they do, and they have to protect it, you know, vigorously against any sort of poachers. And I don't know. I think this is why is that the case? I don't know. I think it's a partially an increased kind of lack of confidence and faith and common sense in something like that. I think also it's a case that there's more and more material comes out. You know, there's more and more information. So the idea that any one person could kind of, you know, house it all, or a good you know, portion of it inside their own head in any worthwhile way seems to be, you know, not accepted anymore. But it's not, you know, there are people. I mean, I don't talk about him in here because he's not an occult figure, but the literary critic and sort of literary, you know, philosopher and professor, George Steiner, is one of these last kind of polymath kind of characters who hit his fingers in lots of different pies, and you know, he writes about all this kind of stuff too. But even in his career in academia, he got into quite a bit of, you know, he got quite a bit of flack about this. And I don't know. I just think we seem to move more and more and more into this age of specialization, and you're supposed to only do one thing, and that's it. But I mean, as you say, the people in here, like someone like Swedenborg, Emanuel Swedenborg, the Swedish scientist and then religious thinker. Well, I just said it there. He started out as a scientist. He was one of the most well-known scientific thinkers of his time in the early 18th century. He wrote reams about astronomy and also about the brain and anatomy, and many of the things that he speculated on then have since become you know, part of standard kind of model in astronomy and in neuroscience, things of that sort. Steiner, Rudolf Steiner, he started out as a Goethe scholar. He edited the scientific writings of the German poet and dramatist Goethe, and then he also lectured on Nietzsche. He knew quite, he was a polymath. He was one of these universal educationalists. And then he himself developed a whole system of education, which is what he's most known for today. It's either called Steiner education or Waldorf education, and the schools are all over the world. But he also developed innovations in agriculture, in medicine, architecture. One of the most remarkable buildings that exists today is what's called the Goethe-Annum. This fantastic structure of expressionist architecture that Steiner, well, there were two of them. The first one was built during World War I in Dornach, Switzerland. And Switzerland was neutral during World War I, And Steiner had students from all the different warring countries. So he had Germans and Austrians and French and English all working together, building this incredible structure. It's a fantastic, I mean, it doesn't exist. It was burned to the ground on Christmas Eve 1922, I believe. It was a tragic thing. People had worked on it for years, and it was made of this fantastic wood that the best violins in Europe had been made of, and so on and so on. And it had one huge dome that was bigger than the dome at St. Peter's in Rome. And there were no curve, there were no straight lines, there were no right angles, it was all curves. I mean, there's photographs of it. And the second one that still exists today, that still stands, is made of concrete, so it wouldn't burn. And it looks like some fantastic thing out of a sci-fi kind of fantasy movie, or something like that. It almost looks like something Batman would live in a way. You know, it has these fantastic curves and peaks, and it has a strange kind of, you know, weird shape to it. And Steiner, you know, just designed it. And then it was one of the first buildings to use reinforced concrete in this kind of way. So he had his hand, you know, fingers in many, many different pies. Jung, who's obviously, you know, best known as a psychologist, but less well known. He was an artist as well. In fact, he went out of his way to try and tell people he wasn't an artist. But if anyone has seen The Red Book, this remarkable account of his kind of what he called his descent into the unconscious, or his psychotic breakdown, depending on what perspective you want to take, that took place over a few years after he and Freud fell out. He has these incredibly complex watercolors in there, and equally complex calligraphy of these fantastic kind of poetic, mythic sort of stories that are records of his inner experiences. So yeah, you're right. I mean, many of these people, Crowley, you know, again, he's someone who I think he had his finger in too many pies, because he didn't quite settle into, aside from being a magician, he didn't quite settle into any of the other ones fully, and I think he could have been, you know, maybe not a poet. I think one of his problems, he fancied himself a poet, obviously, and not, to my taste, the poetry isn't, it's not that great. There's some pieces that work, but on the whole, I think he misjudged his creative potential there. Others disagree, but he was a chess master. He was something of a mathematician. He was a mountaineer. He made two attempts on the Himalayas, and he also climbed some remarkable peaks in Mexico, not to mention the Alps and so on and so on. So yeah, you have all these people that do lots of things. They're these larger than life characters, unlike the kind of specialization that you know, it seems to be the way things are going today. You know, they were big. And again, a big person making mistakes is often more fruitful than, you know, kind of very cautious, smaller individuals who are right. But their accuracy is, you know, often, you know, trivial compared to some of the flops that the geniuses make.
Okay, you mentioned Emanuel Swedenborg there. Now, that's most of the names in your book are obviously familiar to me, some more so than others. Now, this is one that I'd seen cited a lot, Swedenborg, but I didn't really know what he and his life and his work were about. But extremely interesting character, and along the lines of what we've just been speaking about, into so many different things. And it's amazing, actually, that his inventions and his practical skills that he turned his hand to were really only, it was almost like him just getting started, if you see what I mean, all the work, all the government work that he did, and all the, just, again, amazing that any one person was capable of all this.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think these people, you know, put us to shame. You know, somehow we stopped making them at some point, you know, where they did lots of things, and they were very good at all of them. But, you know, Swedenborg started out, he had a bent for science, he had a bent for engineering, and he wound up basically working with Christopher Polhin, who was at the time, this is again the early 1700s, the most famous sort of scientist and inventor in Sweden at the time. And he was given several, you know, very, very difficult jobs, you know, to do. One of them was to install these dry docks at a famous port, Swedish port. Another was to start the first Swedish salt mines. And then Swedenborg later became a sort of mining assessor. He went around Sweden checking out all the mines and making sure everything was, you know, working well and all that kind of thing. And that in itself led to his interest in mineralogy. And he wrote huge, huge tomes about mineralogy. He was also a remarkable thing at the time during a war between Norway and Sweden. Swedenborg was given the job of moving the Swedish fleet about 15 miles across dry land, you know, to get, you know, the one body of water to get into this other. And so he had to figure out how to do that, and pretty quickly, so that they could be, you know, put into use at this battle. So he did all these remarkable, so any one of these kind of things, you know, would have been enough for him to, you know, got a claim. Certainly, so many of them, it would have meant that, you know, he had a career assured for the rest of his life. But he had bigger game in mind. So at the same time he was doing this sort of engineering work, he also made all these designs for a variety of inventions. He developed a kind of early machine gun. He developed a kind of early submarine. He developed a kind of early, almost home entertainment sort of system, you know, a kind of machine that played music and did a variety of other sorts of things like that. And these are all sort of, you know, things he had blueprints for and plans and so on and so on. But even with he was ambitious. When he was a young man, he was ambitious, and he wanted to make a name for himself. And he also traveled quite a bit in search of knowledge, as many of these people did too. You know, that's another theme that comes up with a lot of these figures. They all traveled a great deal and met others and learned from them and so on. Swedenborg did that, traveling throughout Europe. He came to England quite a few times. And he just missed winning the prize that Greenwich Observatory had set for someone to develop how to determine longitude and latitude at sea. I think he just missed out. John Harrison won, you know, but he was close. And he was hoping to make a big name for himself in these sorts of ways. And then he devoted his attentions to more sort of abstract kind of theoretical science. And after meeting and conversing with many of the leading scientists of the day, he wrote, as I said, huge tracts about astronomy. And he seemed to have had ideas about black holes well in advance of, you know, us. You know, they only recently, you know, fairly recently, in the last 50 or 60 years, more or less. The nebula theory of galactic and planetary formation, he had early versions of that. That's usually attributed to Kant, Immanuel Kant, and the French astronomer Pierre-Simon Laplace, but there's good reason to believe that Swedenborg wrote about it earlier, and Kant may have read it, because Kant was interested in Swedenborg. And also things, you know, as I said about the brain, he was one of the first ones to talk about neurons. He early on spoke about the differences between the, you know, the two cerebral hemispheres. And his interest in anatomy led to certain observations about the kind of synchronism between the brain and the blood flow. All these sorts of things that subsequently have become, as I said earlier, become, you know, just part of what we understand, you know, the science of astronomy and neuroscience to be about. And then even that, even after that, he wasn't completely satisfied, and he wanted to find, as had René Descartes, the French philosopher and mathematician before him, he wanted to find the seat of the soul. You know, he wanted to find where is it in the body where you know the spiritual realm and the physical realm meet. There had to be some place. This was a big idea. I mean, we're not really concerned about this these days, because, you know, we don't believe this is spiritual, so it's all, you know, it's all somehow physical, according to, you know, standard issues these days. But no, I was going to say Swedenborg was determined to discover this, and it was through his pursuit of this, of the seat of the soul idea, that he subsequently abandoned science and became a sort of spiritual, a religious philosopher.
Yeah, he anticipated basically the limitations of Newtonian physics and,
absolutely,
and the idea that science would not, it could not lead to the soul, really, which is something that you hear, it's much bandied about today, you know, when we have so-called spiritual science ideas coming up, you know, but this is like so far in advance of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, this is in the 1700s. But it was, in a way, it was after he had exhausted all of the, what we would call, you know, scientific means of trying to arrive at answers to these questions. We have a kind of skewed idea of what the Enlightenment was in many ways, because many of the people that were involved that we considered, you know, Enlightenment figures, and Swedenborg would be considered one, they also had an interest in what we call the occult or the spiritual. They were interested in both. They were interested in understanding the physical world, the new natural sciences that were coming, but they also were trying to relate that to the older Hermetic, Neoplatonic, religious kind of philosophies. And so it wasn't this clear kind of break. You know, I mean, everybody knows these days that Newton wrote more about alchemy than he did about gravity. Mm. He was absolutely mad about it. You know, he was obsessed. So the kind of standard idea that, oh, at one point, you know, Western man became rational and jettisoned all that sort of stuff, and that was the Enlightenment. It's not really true. It's a very sort of, you know, highly edited version of the story. But as I was saying, at the same time that Swedenborg was pursuing all these scientific disciplines, he was also studying a variety of different esoteric ideas. By himself, from an early age, he had developed this whole system of breathing, this kind of breathing exercises that he did that put him into altered states of consciousness. So he developed different kinds of, again, his own ways of meditation. But he also studied Kabbalah. He was very interested in sort of what we would call a kind of tantric, a kind of Western tantra, sort of esoteric spiritualism that he became aware of through... there was an interesting figure in the London of that time named Rabbi Falk, who had come from Galicia, from eastern Poland, and he was called the Baal Shem. He was one of these sort of Kabbalistic teachers. And there's elements of an erotic spirituality in Kabbalah. Swedenborg also picked up other elements of this from his time spent with the Moravians, who were these people that started out as Bohemians, and they had left Bohemia during the 30 Years' War and traveled across sort of Europe as kind of sort of internal immigrants as a way, and eventually wound up on the estate of this German Count Zinzendorf, who became converted to their belief, and he had this strange mystical experience looking at this painting of Christ, and he developed this whole kind of, to our mind, very strange kind of sexual spirituality based on the crucified Christ. So I'm just mentioning this because, again, Swedenborg spent a lot of time in London, and he was moving in this milieu where there were lots of this sort of thing going on, and people were really interested in a variety of different kinds of things. So it wasn't like suddenly, oh, everyone was interested in science, and they chucked all the other stuff away. That's kind of the whitewashed sort of picture that increasingly, you know, I think in recent years is becoming more well known that many of these Enlightenment figures also, you know, had a deep interest in what we would consider a cult these days. And so Swedenborg was one of these. And, you know, and what happened to Swedenborg was that he went through this crisis, very similar to the one that Jung went through after his breakup with Freud, and he started having these visionary experiences. He had a visitation by Christ. Angels came to him, and they took him on these inner journeys to heaven and hell and to this intermediate realm called the spirit world, and also to other planets. And Swedenborg is not an easy read. He's certainly not a page-turner. But if you're interested, the best volume to start with is this book called Heaven and Hell, which are a collection of these kind of little stories. It's sort of like a rough guide, you know, to heaven and hell. They're kind of, this is what it's like there. This is how the angels live. This is the kind of houses they live in and all that. And it all sounds a bit quaint, but it's all symbolic. It's all written in this kind of symbolic language. And Swedenborg developed this idea of correspondences, that there's a correspondence between the physical world and the spiritual one, which is, you know, the same thing as the Hermetic idea of as above, so below, and similar ideas in Kabbalah. And he kind of spells out, you know, a tree in the physical world means this in the spiritual world, and a rose in the physical world means this in the sun, and so on and so on. But this idea of correspondences was picked up by the poet Charles Baudelaire, French poet Charles Baudelaire, who was reading the Swedenborg. He developed it in his own particular way through his poetry. But this subsequently became the art and aesthetic movement symbolism, which had an enormous influence on Europe in the mid to late 19th century. And it comes out of Swedenborg. So here's an example of, you know, a kind of real large-scale kind of cultural phenomena that in many ways has its roots in this sort of esoteric tradition.
Well, you mentioned traveling, and now the characters that you write about in the book, you know, you're covering a time span of several centuries, so we've got 20th century figures in there, as well as some of these people from you know, previous ages, but a lot of them were doing a lot of this traveling when it was not so easy to travel as it is sure. These days. You couldn't just hop on a jet and be, you know, halfway around the world in half a day.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's you're absolutely right. It isn't like today where, you know, people, you know, go to the east, you know, and are back the next day for lunch or something like that. No, you have the great travelers like Madame Blavatsky. And if only half of the stories about her is true, she still was, you know, a remarkable character. You know, who went around the world, you know, the main kind of debatable thing about her is whether she actually went to Tibet or not, but I don't know. I mean, I keep an open mind about it, but even if she didn't, she certainly, you know, traveled elsewhere. She went across the States in a, you know, in a covered wagon, things of that sort, was all over Europe and Egypt and Greece and obviously through Russia. And then, you know, other people like Uspensky. I mentioned this, you know, my mini Search of the Miraculous. Well, that's taken from Uspensky's own Search of the Miraculous when he traveled in the early 20th century to Egypt and India and Ceylon and Central Asia in search of esoteric schools, in search of, you know, hidden mysteries and so on. Crowley is another one. You know, he's another one went around the world and so on. So, and then you have this whole kind of motif of what was known as the noble traveler in the 18th century. And these are these characters who crisscrossed Europe. I mean, Cagliostro, who I don't talk about in the book, but I guess he's sort of an archetypal example of that. Someone I do talk about in the book, who's not that well known, is the Polish writer Jan Patacki, who wrote this fantastic book called Manuscript Found in Saragossa, which is this incredible kind of European Arabian Nights. But he was an ethnographer. You know, he traveled many strange different places and did, you know, sort of an early anthropologist.
That concludes part one of our interview. Be sure to tune in next week for part two. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.